You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of November 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Cyprus joins the ranks of the pigs as the fifth European nation requesting a bailout. We'll assess what this means for the nation and the region with the author and journalist Constantine Bouhea. Now, the former First Lady of the Côte d'Ivoire, Simone Gbagbo, has won the dubious accolade of being the first woman to be wanted for arrest by the International Criminal Court. Alex Duval-Smith will bring us a special report from Africa.
The youth wing of her party is accused of having run death squads and may have killed up to 3,000 people in the run-up and aftermath of the 2010 election.
And as Tahrir Square once again resounds with the chants of protesters, we ask whether Mohamed Morsi could become a victim of the same popular anger that cleared his path to power.
Everybody has to have a dream. If we don't have a dream, then we are dead.
Plus, our associate editor will talk us through some of the highlights from this month's edition of the magazine. Lots more still to come then in the next hour here on Midori House. Let's get started with a roundup of the world news headlines. Here's Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. The EU budget summit in Brussels has broken up without agreement. The European Council President, Herman Van Rompuy, called off negotiations after leaders remained deeply divided after 2 days, rather than try to continue into the weekend. Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron says the budget deal being offered was not good enough. He says what had been suggested amounted to tinkering with spending. Israeli troops have shot and killed a Palestinian man and wounded at least 15 others after crowds surged towards Gaza's border fence with Israel. It's the first reported killing since the ceasefire between Hamas and Israel came into force on Wednesday evening. The Israel Defense Forces say they fired warning shots at a group walking towards the fence, then fired at their legs when they did not respond. Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas prime minister in Gaza, has urged militant factions to continue to respect the ceasefire. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad Malki says the shooting could be seen as a violation of the truce agreement.
It's very clear that sometimes agreements of this nature, ceasefire and truce, might find certain resistance among few. So I hope that what happened today is only an exception rather than the norm, and that the Israelis will abide by the agreements that was really reached by Egypt and have to respect it.
Violent clashes have broken out in cities across Egypt in a day of protest after President Mohamed Morsi granted himself sweeping new powers. In Alexandria, Egypt's second largest city, protesters stormed the headquarters of Mr. Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood Party, throwing chairs and books into the street and setting them on fire. Thousands have gathered in Tahrir Square in Cairo, the scene of the violent clashes during the overthrow of the former president Hosni Mubarak. Monocle's Joseph Dana, who's in Cairo, told us the decrees created a volatile situation.
This is really going to be one of the most profound challenges to Morsi's rule that we've seen really since he's taken power, and everything hangs in the balance. If the protests are really quashed with a very strong hand, this could send Egypt back into a kind of spiraling of chaos.
Pakistan is suspending phone coverage in many cities this weekend after a series of bomb attacks on Shiites triggered by mobile phones. Hardline Sunnis have threatened more attacks as the Shiite mourning month of Muharram comes to a climax. More than a dozen people have already been killed this week attending Muharram processions. An elderly British man has been killed after his car was swept away by floodwaters in Somerset. The man died of a cardiac arrest on the way to hospital after being rescued from his car by emergency services. Heavy rain and winds of more than 86 miles an hour have left thousands of homes without power in southwest England and Wales. A circus owner in the UK has been found guilty on 3 counts of causing unnecessary suffering to a performing elephant. 69-year-old Bobby Roberts was given a 3-year conditional discharge for mistreating the 58-year-old elephant called Anne. The court had been shown secretly filmed footage of the animal being struck with a pitchfork by a groom. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Bill. It's 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
Londres. Isto é Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle 26.
From London,
London, London, cara.
De long, de long.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House, live from Studio One in Midori House in London. Now, Cyprus is on the verge of joining an exclusive club. Its existing members, number four, and the conditions of joining involve wholehearted adoption of austerity principles and scheduled payments to creditors for many years to come. Yes, like Portugal, Ireland, Greece and Spain, it has agreed a deal in principle to get bailed out. The details are being finalised at this moment, but will likely include some $16 billion of loans. So while the acronym enthusiasts who so enjoyed pigs rush for their pens and paper, how did Cyprus slide so far into the red? And what are creditors likely to demand from it now? Well, we're joined on the line by Southern Europe specialist and author of Greek Culture Smart, Constantine Bouher. Welcome, Constantine, to Midori House. I presume, how did this happen? The answer can be summed up in one word: Greece. Is it that simple?
Not exactly. Indeed, you asked a very good question. How did it slide so far? Let's just remember where Cyprus stood. When it joined the European Union, it was one of the leading lights. It could have joined directly the Eurozone. It was considered to be the tiger of the East Mediterranean, the Singapore of the region. It was proud of its of British officialdom, of its procedures, of its developed infrastructure. Therefore, this is not a country that could possibly go wrong. And yet suddenly, before it took over the European Union presidency in June, it started asking for aid and everything started to tumble. Indeed, the reason, which is pointed out, for this collapse is its exposure to the Greek banks. However, many Cypriots believe it is also due to the inefficient government of President Christofias, the current president of Cyprus.
Well, let's come back to that one. I mean, how significant is, obviously, we talked about the exposure to Greek banks. What about the sort of trade relationship? If businesses in Greece were collapsing and demand was falling for businesses in Cyprus, has that had an effect?
It obviously would have an effect. However, there were other things which kept Cyprus' economy shored up. It's offshore companies. It had its financial services, its shipping. These were not necessarily exposed to the Greek banks. That is why a lot of questions have been raised, specifically in Cyprus. How could just the exposure of the Greek banks bring the country to the, make it, you know, it's sort of, its credit rating now is junk. It is, many believe, the fact that President Christofias was unwilling or unable to accept the advice which was given to him by very sound Cypriot financiers. And let us remember, Cyprus won the Nobel Prize for in the economy, Pitsilidis, two years ago. So it has extremely good brains, financial brains in Cyprus, and people are pointing to Christofias.
So is his position in question at the moment?
Well, there will be elections in February, presidential elections. He is not standing again. And therefore, the speculation is that he will delay the signing of the final agreement with the Troika until after the elections. He does not wish to be the president who signed the agreement with the Troika. Whether he'll be able to get away with this or not is a different matter altogether.
We've seen some of the quite complicated reactions to the demands of bailout packages in those other nations that we were talking about. Have you got any idea about what sort of appetite or not for austerity there will be in Cyprus? How willing people will be to be stoic?
There's been a very large population is what we might call nouveau riche. There's a competitive purchasing power, you know, who spends more than the other. Therefore, this will be cut. Their wages will be cut. They have been prepared to a large extent by what is happening in the so-called pigs. And therefore, I think they're willing to take cuts in their own standards of living. certainly there are jobs that have been lost, and the bankruptcy has increased to a tremendous extent in Cyprus.
What about the conditions of this bailout? Have we got any idea yet on what Cyprus will have to do, what conditions it will have to meet in order to receive these payments?
No. In fact, the Cypriots have been working behind closed doors, and there's a tradition of this. And when negotiating with the Turkish Cypriot North, a lot of these things happen behind closed doors. It's not transparent. What the government said recently, is that they will not sell profitable state-owned companies to the to the private sector. And also, there is a lot of disagreement or haggling over what will happen with their gas reserves, which is their offshore gas reserves. What saying will their creditors have over that potential treasure? In effect, in about an hour's time, President Christakis will be addressing the Cypriot people and telling them a few perhaps home truths. More will become clear in an hour's time.
Do we have any idea about what he might say?
No, that is typically of Cyprus as well. Uh-huh. We do not know what he'll be saying. He has certainly. People said of Christakis, Cyprus used to have a problem. Now Christakis is the problem. Also, what other people are saying, there was a cartoon that somewhere there's a village missing its idiot. They're not very kind to Christakis, perhaps rightly or wrongly. And they won't be groundbreaking, what he'll say. But he'll hammer home the news that it's going to be bad times for Cyprus coming in the next few years.
I mean, I guess he has a responsibility to sort of rhetorically sort of prepare the ground and prepare his people in that way. I mean, one sort of alternate outcome of this that I was reading about was that there was at one stage mooted the possibility of a loan from someone outside the EU, that Russia and China were possibly interested in sort of supplying that bailout money themselves.
Russia, because it's the so-called Communist Party, he says so-called Communist, Cypriot style, President Christakis, and the Communist Party had long and extensive links with the Soviet Union and with Russia, its traditional ally to that party. Therefore, it was seen as a natural contributor. In fact, all this has been withdrawn from the table. It was seen as negotiating tactics rather than a hard fact, a hard sort of signatures on paper. It's the Troika with whom the Cypriots will have to deal.
And staying on the subject of those Russians then, I mean, you alluded briefly before to the large offshore financial sector that Cyprus has sort of built up. What effect will there be then on the people who have got money invested there? Is that likely to be affected at all for all of those rich Russians, amongst whom I imagine the investors number?
This hasn't been raised, as far as we know, by the Troika, and it hasn't been raised by the Cyprus government. And as far as I can tell, there haven't been many concerns raised there. Indeed, if there's already an outflow of investors in that respect, Russians especially, because they're finding other offshore possibilities other than Cyprus. If anything happens there, I don't think it'll be because of the crisis. It'll be because the Russians are finding more profitable areas to pump their money.
Constantine, always interesting to hear from you. Thank you for joining us on Midori House. That's Constantine Bouhair. We'll be back in a moment to find out if Mohamed Morsi's decree may yet be his undoing.
If you think the print industry is on its last legs, then you haven't tuned into The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly review of the best in paper, ink, varnishes, and glue. Every Saturday morning, we sit down with an informed group of editors, journalists, art directors, and photographers to flip through their favorite periodicals.
There's a huge amount of arrogance going into this, but it's got confidence and pride, and that makes for a fantastic end result.
It's a matter of pride to be involved in certain magazines. It's not about the reach and numbers, it's about the reach and quality.
Matte or glossy, saddle stitched or perfect bound, The Stack is an hour of opinions, predictions, and proclamations about all the titles we hoard, archive, and savour.
There is a real difference, and the difference will become more sharply edged as time goes on.
The biggest breakfast buffet of magazines and newspapers is served up every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, and a passionate mix of print aficionados.
I think it's real when it's ink. You can take it home and it doesn't flicker.
On Monocle's Culture Show, we want to be like the fabled Hydra, one of the great monsters of Greek myth, but in a good way. Listen to one fascinating story and two more eagerly pop up to replace it. So it's only scary if you're frightened of the following sorts of things. Reports from all over the world on art, books, magazines, media, music, film, publishing, advertising, and photography. Or if you're terrified of beautifully performed, intimate live music sessions from some of our favourite acts recorded in our performance space right here at Midori House. It's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. It premieres on Mondays at 1900 London time, and frankly, it's the heroic Hercules that defeats the evil Hydra of radio boredom. Join us and enjoy the legend.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Dominic Reynolds. It's 16 minutes past six here in London. Now, Cairo's Tahrir Square has witnessed the chants of thousands of protesters today. They say their leader has become an autocrat, blind to what his people want, and they're calling for revolution. Yes, it does sound bizarrely similar to the chain of events which brought Mohamed Morsi to power, but this has been the response to his declaration of new far-reaching powers. His opponents say the changes make the office of president, which Morsi happens to hold at the moment, of course, far too powerful. Now, in the past few hours, there have been reports of attacks on Muslim Brotherhood offices across the country, and Morsi himself has spoken to try and quell the anger. Let's find out what he said and what the reaction has been. Our man Joseph Dana is in Cairo with the latest. Hi, Joseph. Welcome back to Midori House. What's the feeling on the ground?
Well, the feeling is quite tense. It's definitely getting close to kind of very strongly reminiscent images of the actual Egyptian revolution itself. Let's just rewind for a second. President Morsi addressed his Muslim Brotherhood supporters this afternoon, which is very interesting. He did not address the country, as it were. He did not go on state television and address all of the people. He gave a very kind of impassioned, almost verbose 45-minute speech to his supporters that sounded a bit like a State of the Union speech. And as this was unfolding, just kind of about 10 kilometers away from Tahrir Square, the square was just flooded with pro-democracy kind of, I would even say, anti-Morsi protesters. And the police forces and security forces kind of unleashed waves of tear gas. And that's basically what we have now on the ground. Tear gas and a lot of angry Egyptians in Tahrir Square.
Joseph, you were there just after the fall of Mubarak, just over 18 months ago. How sort of feasible is that comparison in the atmospheres?
It's definitely feasible. I mean, the images are very starkly reminiscent, but it's not nearly on the size of the Egyptian Revolution. The best estimates that I've seen this evening is about maybe 20, 30,000 protesters, which is very significant kind of going into Tahrir Square. I mean, what this really is a demonstration of is how difficult the kind of revolutionary transition has been in Egypt. I think it's safe to say that when the history books are written, a lot of people will look back on the Egyptian kind of transition as one of the worst. And it's really just, you know, there's so many hiccups along the way. And the declaration by Morsi yesterday, giving himself really, you know, far-reaching, almost dictatorial powers, which is what some people here have called them, is definitely a big road bump or roadblock in the path to, you know, proper transition to full-fledged democracy.
Now, Joseph, I believe that you've been speaking to protesters and you've got some audio for us. Before we hear it, tell us who we're going to hear from.
Well, this is a very interesting gentleman. I was, for most of the day, I was on a roof above Tahrir Square. And one of the residents inside of the building, so this is someone that's been living on Tahrir Square for the entirety of the revolution, kind of came up and started chatting with me, and he spoke a decent English, and so we had a nice conversation, and that's, you know, we're going to hear kind of his feelings on the day.
My name is Mahmoud. You don't have to bring with you the trustable people. But I think the people with experience will be better. I don't like that you are the president or you are the chargeable man somewhere, and then you bring the people you trust them to help you. That's not going to work.
What do you think is going to happen today in Tahrir?
It's some kind of pressure to change the situation a little bit, to make some kind of change. Everybody has to have a dream. If we don't have a dream, then we are dead.
Joseph, it's really interesting to hear that, and it makes me wonder. We can hear the sound of protests there. Are the protests sort of splitting along party lines, or are there still are there Muslim Brotherhood supporters who still think what Morsi's doing is undemocratic and unwise?
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood supporters are definitely very, very much in support of Morsi, and they. I'm happily able to report that they stayed away from Tahrir Square. A lot of the worry in Cairo was that if a flood of Muslim Brotherhood supporters kind of came into the square, it would be very horrific kind of episodes of violence. The opposition, the kind of pro-democracy opposition, has not so far showed that much fragmentation, at least today. And I think that the sentiments that that this gentleman was saying very much kind of captures this feeling that this still is a revolution in progress. You know, people still do have dreams of living in a democratic system, and yet they understand that they're not there. And so this is just another kind of spot in the map of how far the Egyptians have to go in order to really complete this revolution that's been going on for what? It's 20 months now of turmoil that's kind of taken over this massive city of Cairo. And, you know, how many more times are people going to flood into Tahrir, and how many more people might have to die in order for this country to really come out of such a dark period in its history?
Well, given that it is a process of evolution, as you paint for us there, what does that mean for Morsi now? And just briefly, if you could, Joseph, can he go back on this decree? And if he can't, where does he go?
Well, it looks like he's very much doubled down on his desire to install these very, very far-reaching powers. And this is very much about the Constitution. He's trying to set up a situation in which the future Egyptian constitution is going to have a very strongly Islamic character to it. It's going to be a very strongly kind of Muslim Brotherhood constitution. And that's probably the driving force behind him, you know, issuing these declarations and reaffirming his own power. And so I think we're going to continue to see that trend. But surely he must be somewhat surprised at the kind of veracity of the reaction on the street. The people that I've been speaking with on the ground, they understood that there was a problem here. They understood that they're far away from achieving this, you know, democratic ideal that I've been talking about. But they didn't really see such a big protest taking over Tahrir today. And so that leaves it as anyone's guess as to what's going to happen tomorrow and the following day.
Joseph, always interesting to talk to you. Thanks for coming on Midori today. That's Joseph Dana in Cairo. Coming up, the dubious accolade of the first woman wanted for arrest by the International Criminal Court. Simone Gbagbo, step up. You are listening to Midori House, today with me, Dominic Reynolds. Now, the International Criminal Court has asked the government of the West African country of Côte d'Ivoire to send the country's former First Lady, Simone Gbagbo, for trial in The Hague. She would come to court alongside her husband, former President Laurent Gbagbo, who's already a prisoner there. Simone's arrest warrant alleges that she was criminally responsible for murder, rape, other forms of sexual violence, other inhumane acts and persecution during violence last year that followed Laurent Gbagbo's refusal to accept that he'd lost the presidential election. Well, Alex Duval-Smith has been delving into the life story of the first woman to be indicted by the International Criminal Court.
The arrest warrant against the Gbagbo couple dates back to February. It led to the imprisonment in April of the 63-year-old former First Lady and her husband, Laurent Gbagbo. He was swiftly sent to The Hague, but the International Criminal Court waited until now to request the transfer of the former First Lady. The current Ivorian president, Alassane Ouattara, had asked for the delay on grounds of national stability. And that suggests that, if anything, the tentacles of Mrs. Gbagbo's influence are more tangled and potentially more harmful than those of her husband. If you go to www.simonegbagbo.com, yes, she has a website, it doesn't offer the usual First Lady fare of charitable works, orphans and breastfeeding mothers. Emblazoned with portraits of Simone, one of which makes her look remarkably like Michelle Obama, it invites you to delve into four headings: strong woman, committed woman, beautiful woman and woman of vision. But of course, there's much more to the International Criminal Court's first indicted woman. A strong woman she is. The daughter of a gendarme, she grew up with 17 siblings and quickly learnt to stand out from the crowd. Simone was active in Catholic youth groups and later in the trade union movement. An applied linguist, her work on the Akan people includes a study of traditional warriors' expressions entitled The War Lexicon. Committed she is too, mainly to her second husband Laurent's Ivorian Popular Front party. Simone dedicated her life to getting Laurent out of opposition, into government, and for him to remain there for the decade leading up to 2011. Second husband, you heard correctly, this committed Catholic couldn't abide Rome's intolerance of the remarriage of divorcees. Under Beautiful Woman, we find Simone and Laurent Gbagbo in various poses of happiness with their two daughters. After a car accident in 1996, which Simone is convinced was an attempt on their lives, the couple became born-again Christians. They're close to the American Four Square Pentecostal Evangelical Church. Simone has no time for the Dioula ethnic group of the north of Côte d'Ivoire. They're Muslims, as is incumbent President Ouattara. Simone Gbagbo sees her country as a battlefield for Christianity. Under Woman of Vision on the website, we're given contact details for the woman who hasn't updated her status to ex-First Lady. But if you don't contact Simone, she has ways of finding you. The International Criminal Court will be particularly interested in what Simone has to say about the young patriots. The youth wing of her party is accused of having run death squads and may have killed up to 3,000 people in the run-up and aftermath of the 2010 election. Simone Gbagbo's personal head of security has been named by the United Nations as a suspected commander of the death squads. She's also been linked to the murder of Guy-André Kieffer, a Canadian journalist who disappeared in 2004 while investigating corruption in the Ivorian cocoa industry. President Ouattara has yet to indicate whether he now considers it safe for Mrs. Gbagbo to be sent to join her husband in The Hague. No forces loyal to the current government have been arrested, despite evidence of atrocities on both sides. This has raised fears of victor's justice. Unlike most war criminals, who as a rule are arrested well into retirement, the Gbagbo couple still have a powerful support base in Côte d'Ivoire. For Monocle in Cape Town, I'm Alex Duval-Smith.
I do recommend that website of Simone Gbagbo. It's quite a good read. Now, staying in Africa and taking us to the half-hour news, here's Julia by Walk Heart of Africa. Tima iwalaso kutitandengo wabadali Ukapeza chikondi nchofunika kutisamalira Poti mongatira sichichedwa kuzweka Julia, Julia. That was Julia by Warm Heart of Africa. Now, in the next half hour of the programme, what difference will it make to rename the United States of Mexico, Mexico? We'll find out. Plus, our sections editor, Santiago Rodriguez Tartiti, will talk us through some of the editorial highlights from this month's section of the magazine. All that and more. But first is Bill Bingham with the World News headlines.
The EU budget summit in Brussels has broken up without agreement. The European Council President, Herman Van Rompuy, called off negotiations after leaders remained deeply divided after 2 days of talks. Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron says what had been suggested amounted to tinkering with spending. Israeli troops have shot and killed a Palestinian man and wounded at least 15 others after crowds surged towards Gaza's border fence with Israel. It's the first reported killing since the ceasefire between Hamas and Israel came into force on Wednesday evening. Violent clashes have broken out in cities across Egypt in a day of protest after President Mohamed Morsi granted himself sweeping new powers. In Alexandria, Egypt's second largest city, protesters stormed the headquarters of Mr. Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood Party, throwing chairs and books into the street and setting them on fire. Thousands have gathered in Tahrir Square in Cairo, the scene of the violent clashes during the overthrow of the former president Hosni Mubarak. Pakistan is suspending phone coverage in many cities this weekend after a series of bomb attacks on Shiites triggered by mobile phones. Hardline Sunnis have threatened more attacks as the Shiite mourning month of Muharram comes to a climax. An elderly British man has been killed after his car was swept away by floodwaters in Somerset. The man died of a cardiac arrest on the way to hospital after being rescued from his car by emergency services. Heavy rain and winds of more than 86 miles an hour have left thousands of homes without power in southwest England and Wales. A circus owner in the UK has been found guilty on three counts of causing unnecessary suffering to a performing elephant. 69-year-old Bobby Roberts was given a three-year conditional discharge for mistreating the 58-year-old elephant called Anne. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Bill. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. We're coming to you live from London as ever. Now, with the latest edition of Monocle out this week and gracing the shelves of your better local bookstores, each day we on Midori House will draw your attention to some of the stories the magazine's focusing on. Today, our associate editor, Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi, joins us in the studio to talk through some of the highlights from the edit section. Welcome, Santiago. How are you?
Thank you, Dom. Pretty well, and you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Enjoying the festivities around here today. Auspicious day. Now, it's a beautifully designed sort of separate section we have here this month. I've got the sort of contents page in front of me, numbers 1 to 50. Where are we starting?
So you're looking at the Travel Top 50. This mm-hmm. is our annual survey of the best in the travel industry. And what we do is just go around the world, get our correspondents, our writers to tell us what over the past year has really caught their eye in terms of innovation and coziness, warmth. What is the industry doing?
So this isn't just about destinations. It's about
not
it's
at
about
all. Not at all.
Beyond it, that, it's the elements within.
It could be. We have everything from the best for a shopping expedition. In this case, the Toyota Alphard, one of Toyota's Japanese vans, to the best barista. One of my favorites, I actually made a selection of five of my favorite elements in this little survey.
Great.
And we can start with number 43.
43 looks like best in-flight blankets.
Exactly. So these are...
It's rather cold in the studio, actually, so this is the perfect item for us now.
I think we have some upstairs, so I'll bring you one down.
It'll be too late. Thank you.
But these are from a brand called Teishi Doors. They're Spanish and they're made with cashmere, merino wool, and linen. And the company has mills around Spain. And what's really nice about this company is that they also employ disabled people. They give back to society in that way.
They're pretty. They're sort of a sort of charming color as well. I find that when you take the in-flight blankets, they tend to be a range of horrific colors that when you wake from your slumbers are terrible.
No, these are beautiful and they'll make sure to keep you warm.
Okay, what's next?
Let's move to number 35. We've selected Fuji's new XF1 as the best camera for capturing it all.
Aha.
I really like this camera. It's very, very simple design. You can buy it in different colors, in brown, red, or black. And it has 12 megapixel resolution, which is really what you need these days.
And is it quick on the draw? Can it respond quickly when you whip it out of the pocket?
Yeah, it has a less than a second delay between pictures. So
brilliant, that's what I'm after.
I think that'll give you time to take a lot of good pictures when you travel.
Well, that's it. You know, I when I travel, I have the bulky camera.
Yeah, but I you want that. Something that you can keep in your
this
pocket.
This is it. I do that terrible thing of taking it around and using it far too infrequently because I can't be bothered to sort of reassemble it out of the bag. Okay, that's two. What have we got?
Should we move to Wellington? Okay. Because we've selected the city's international airport.
What number is this?
Number 14. For having the best new air terminal. It's dubbed the Rock, and it is a terminal that has been designed by Studio Pacific and Warren and Mahoney, and it can accommodate up to 1,000 passengers per hour, and it is covered in copper, so it has this very rugged look to it.
It's glorious
looking. But if you see the pictures of the inside, the interior, it still manages to be very, very cozy. It has great light, very, very warm leather and wooden furniture. So it's very, very nice.
And it's taken that sort of geometric structure from the outside and really run it as a theme throughout, it seems.
Yeah, very, very sharp edges on the outside, but a very well-rounded inside.
Or interesting.
If we move to number 02.
Oh, we're getting very close now.
Close to the top of the list.
I'm not going to look to one because I want you to surprise me. Okay.
And we selected Stockholm's Arlanda Express as the best taxi-to-train setup. It's a great rail link, very modern, very clean, sharp-looking. And it's the perfect way to commute whenever you fly into Stockholm.
So it's a smooth transfer. That's what we're talking about here.
Exactly.
Lovely.
And finally, number one is my favorite.
I feel like we need a drum roll.
No, do we have one?
Don't do it on the desk. We're not that sort of station, I guess. Yes, tell me about number one.
Hotel Daniel in Vienna. This is a really young hotel, laid back, unfussy, and it is headed by Florian Waitzer. They had their first property in Graz, and now this one in Vienna. And what's really nice about this one is that they have an on-site bakery.
Oh yes.
So every morning when you walk through reception, you get that nice smell of dough raising in the oven.
That's great. Terrible for people who are wheat intolerant, of course, but for those who aren't, it's a paradise.
But they have a gluten-free selection also. And most important of all, they have really cool bicycles to rent. So if you ate too many croissants, you can always take a bicycle around the city.
Well, that's important. Because if there's the wafting smell of freshly baked bread all the time, that is going to be a bit of a problem, isn't it? Certainly the pictures here look delightful. Sort of a kind of rustic edge to it, but quite sort of natural.
Staying
looking
cozy,
as well.
Yeah.
So that's the 50.
That is, yeah. Well, I mean, there are many more I could take you through, but those were part of my selection.
And are you the compiler of this list? Am I talking to the author here?
I contributed with a couple of these, but it was a team effort.
Okay.
We had many of our writers, our correspondents around the world just pitching in and contributing with their experiences and their recommendations.
It's a terrifically useful list as well. I'm going to go and order me up some warming blankets for the second half of the show. But I hear that you are going to bring us musically into the next part of the show. What's the song we're going to hear?
Well, in order to celebrate the top of the list, number one, Daniel, I have a song that is also called Daniel by Bats for Lashes.
Dream of home.
That was the last moments of Bat Falash's song Daniel. Now, you're listening to Midori House, and we'll be back right after this to find out why Mexico is gaming to change its name to Mexico.
This Christmas, Monica will invite you to Midori House for our first Christmas fair. Mixing up the best of Swedish Yule, Japanese Christmaser, and traditional English Yuletide, we'll be serving up festive cheer at the most elegant Christkindlmarkt in the heart of W1. We'll have live music with a Swedish choir, food by Granger & Co, and our hand-picked retailers can help you with your Christmas shopping. Plus, you can meet a real, live reindeer. So, head to number 1 Dorset Street on the 1st and 2nd of December from 11am to 5pm to meet our Finnish Santa and all his little helpers at the Monocle Christmas Fair.
Like there's actually a reindeer in the studio when that happens. Now, you're listening to Midori House, where the time is 18:46 here in London and 12:46 in Mexico City. That, you might be surprised to learn, is the capital not of Mexico, but of the United States of Mexico. Yes, that's the official name of America's southern neighbour. But it might not be for long. That's if outgoing President Felipe Calderon gets his way. He wants his nation's name shortened to give it a bit of a name-ectomy and leave us with plain old Mexico. So given the many serious life and death sort of things that are in Calderon's in-tray, is this an unwise swan song from the outgoing Mexican president or a legitimate attempt to make a symbolic move away from the past? Well, in a moment, we'll find out what this actually means to everyday Mexicans with George Chabat, Professor of International Studies and Teaching Research at the facility CIDE. But first, Bloomberg's Eric Martin, economics and politics reporter. He joins us on the line from Mexico City. Welcome to Midori House, Eric. Perhaps you could give us a bit of background to this. Why is it that this longer name came to be in the first place, and why we just know it by the shorter name?
Oh, this is a name that was adopted during the writing of the Mexican Constitution in 1824, and there were a number of different names that were contemplated at the time. Things like the Republic of Mexico, the Mexican Republic, Mexican America, and in the end they settled on this name because it was meant to emulate the United States, which at that time in history was, you know, one of the first democratic representative democracies in the world and was being used as a model for the democracy that the Constitutional Assembly hoped to repeat in and hoped to introduce in Mexico after its independence from Spain. So that was the reason that United Mexican States was a name that was adopted at that time. President Calderon yesterday in this speech, he is with 1 week to go in his time in office after about 6 years of leading the nation, presented this constitutional proposal, which he had also presented in 2003 when he was a member of the lower house of Congress. It didn't get anywhere at that point, and he's reintroducing it now in his final days. Something that he sees as fitting for Mexico because internationally everyone calls the country Mexico. Children in school, if you ask them, you know, what is the name of the country, most of them would probably say Mexico. And there's just a sense that this longer formal name doesn't really have a purpose at this point. And that's his greatest argument for it.
Well, my name's Dominic, but most people call me Dom. It doesn't mean I definitely want to change my name officially to the shortened version. I mean, is the point here that this is to do with the contemporary relationship with America as distinct from the relationship back in 1824?
Well, President Calderon has at times had conflict with the U.S. during his 6 years in office. The U.S. ambassador to Mexico, Carlos Pascual, resigned in March of 2011 after complaints from Calderon about how he was talking about Mexico and Mexico's prosecution of the war against drug cartels. There are many issues on which Calderon has had agreement with the U.S., such as trade. Trade has been a big part of Calderon's agenda, and Mexico is just welcomed into the Trans-Pacific Partnership that the U.S. is currently leading negotiations for. But there certainly is a sense in some corners that this is a parting shot at the U.S. And the biggest question is why now? Why do this with 1 week left in office? And so many analysts have said that that's the reason. This is the last time in terms of his relevance as leader of Mexico, where he'll have a platform to make these kind of statements and send these kind of messages, and he's taking advantage of that.
Eric, thank you very much for that. We'll pick up some of these points now, but that was Bloomberg's Eric Martin. Let's move on to George Chabat, who's Professor of International Studies at Teaching Research Facility, CIDE. George, thanks for joining us. Tell us, do regular Mexicans run around day to day going, oh, I'm so frustrated by the full long name of our country, and I wish we could just bring it back to being Mexico? Is this something people really care about?
Mexicans really are not very worried about the official name of the country, because we don't use it for almost anything. You can find the name of United States of Mexico, Mexican United States, only in the coins and in the official stationery, but that's all. I mean, for people on the street, Mexico is Mexico, so it doesn't mean something important for people, because we regularly don't refer to the country as the Mexican United States. We talk about Mexico, and that's it.
It's so, if this is indeed a bit of polishing of legacy in people's minds by Calderon, how has the move gone down? Have people reacted warmly to this suggestion?
I think for the common people in the street, it doesn't really matter. You probably, if you talk to common people, regular people, most of them probably are not aware that there is a proposal of coming from Calderon to change the name, and the media has reacted very, very indifferent way to this proposal. It's not an issue in the public discussion. The Congress itself said that, well, this is not a priority, and probably the Congress is not going to discuss that proposal. So, in a nutshell, this is not an issue in Mexico right now. It's not an issue for common people. It's not an issue for the political elite. I mean, it doesn't really matter for most of the people in the country.
Can I presume then that Enrique Peña Nieto, who's the successor, is not going to follow this policy up as a matter of priority?
No, of course not. No, obviously, no, doesn't. No, that's not something important. I mean, Peña Nieto has a lot of issues that are more important for him, and more other proposals that probably matter more than this proposal. So, yeah, I don't think it will be discussed in the future, because, I mean, the previous times that this change of name has been presented to the Congress, it was even discussed by the Congress, though. So I don't think why things should be different right now.
Jorge Chabat, thank you very much for joining us. He's Professor of International Studies at Teaching Research Facility, CIDE. And before that was Bloomberg's Eric Martin, who's economics and politics reporter in Mexico City. Thanks to both of you. You're listening to Midori House with me, Dominic Reynolds. Now, it was a small tragedy when the unique Boulevard Café El Greco, a popular local meeting point as multicultural as the neighbourhood itself, closed its doors this year. But with the new Café Lang, it received a worthy successor. Inspired by the traditional Vienna coffee houses, the Café Lang is a beautiful venue with high ceilings, wooden walls and velvety upholstered benches, serving coffee, snacks and drinks from early morning till late at night. While in Vienna, Monocle's Manon Spindler crossed the Lima Bridge to find out more.
My name is Livio. I'm one of the owner of Café Lang at Lima Platz, where we sit right now. In a beautiful, we call it salon, beautiful room with old benches and tables, little tables. Some people are sitting around us. The house was built in the early 30s. Since the last 33 years, it was a coffee, a pretty well-known coffee in Zurich. 1 year ago, we had the possibility to enter and to do a new coffee. For us, it was really, really important to adapt the design at the years that the house was built in. Because of the coffee was really well known and they had a lot of people frequenting this coffee, we had to look and be really careful that the new coffee fits into this place. We always make the design in-house. We have four entrepreneurs who have three coffees right now in Zurich. We always get inspired by a city most of the time. That's kind of the slogan of the design, but inspiration can come from movies, from fashion, from whatever influences us or whatever we like right now. This specific place now, we were really inspired by the coffee house scene in Vienna, in Austria. We get all the inspiration together and then we mix it new with what we think that fits. We like long-lasting materials like wood, stone. We don't like fashion, something that comes and goes within a day. We like something that stays for forever. During the day, we are a coffee house. We have our own espresso mixture. We have our own coffee mixture. We serve cappuccinos, latte macchiatos. We serve all kind of coffees. We have fresh baked croissant. We have a lot of bakery things. Lunchtime, we have always three menus, which is, I would say, markets. Yeah, it's a market, fresh market kitchen. And in the night, we are a bar, and we have a high quality cocktail menu. We have alcohols which you don't find a lot, so we're really picky on what we take. Everything started with a good espresso almost 5 years ago, where we thought in Zurich there is no good espresso, and we always had to travel over the border to Italy, and once you arrived at the first stop, you had a really, really good espresso, and we thought that could not be it. We opened La Stanza and we tried for 5 years to make the best espresso in town. After this place was running and was a success, we were invited for other pitches. It's the law for the detail, and that in every sense. We try to have a service which is fast and is professional, but for almost which is authentic and sympathetic. I think the interior is, whether you like it or not, it's thought to the end. It has one style or one approach, and we took this approach till the end, so we thought it till the end. My favorite thing about the neighborhood is the mixture of culture, of people, of scenes. You can go and have dinner after 12 o'clock, you can have a drink at 4 o'clock in the night, but you can have a coffee at 5 o'clock in the morning, so that's what I like the most around here.
That was Livio, the proprietor of Café Lang in Zurich, of course. And that's all we have time for today's Midori House. Thanks to our producer, Aled John, and our studio manager, Benjamin Jay. Also our researchers, Imogen Greenledge and Antonia Rogaffa. Next up, after the news, this week's episode of The Menu.